The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. This story is titled The Last Grave by Ken Wetherington, which first appeared in the fall 2020 issue of Back Channels Journal.
My name is Bryce Shipman, and I'm playing Guy Singleton.
And my name is Monica Ho, and I'm playing Jillian May.
Efforts to locate next of kin had failed. Only the gravediggers and I stood in the ancient cemetery among the mounds of exhumed plots encircled by high-rise apartment buildings blocking the morning sun. Otis murmured something about a skeleton crew. The others laughed and leaned on their shovels. I checked my watch. Already a quarter after. The media would not be coming. I nodded to Otis. He climbed aboard the gravedigger, started its engine, and steered it over to the sunken rectangle. The claw descended and scooped up its first load of dirt. 10 years ago, the cremation initiative had provoked fierce controversy. Exhumations were slow in the beginning until media attention declined and the citizenry moved on to other concerns. A few grieving families made feeble protests. But disinterments proceeded at an ever swifter pace, creating a boom for the cremation business, columbaria, and the real estate companies, which scooped up the properties for development. A dragonfly appeared in the sky, made a tight loop, and landed 20 yards away. Its door opened, and a young woman emerged. She wore the ubiquitous video headgear of a news reporter. I signaled Otis to halt the exhumation. He frowned and gave an exasperated shake of his head, but complied. The woman approached.
Jillian May, Dallas Video News.
Guy Singleton, Federal Reclamation Project. Thanks for coming.
This the last one?
As far as we know. I'm sure there are others that have been built over or paved over. And some are in former coastal cities, now submerged. They'll turn up from time to time, but we won't be searching for them. Jillian pointed to the dates on the headstone. Born October 18th, 1939. Died November 24th, 1963.
I guess life was short back then.
It was a lawless time. Everyone had a firearm. I don't think many died of natural causes.
That's a bitch. Man, it's hot as hell here. What's that smell?
What smell? Oh, I think you mean the dirt?
Dirt smells?
Sure. It smells like dirt. How long's it been since you've stood on a patch of earth?
I don't remember. When I was a child, I guess.
I shrugged. What do you need for your story?
A short interview with you and then some footage of the, what do you call it?
Exhumation.
Yeah, that.
The filming and interview went as I supposed they would. She asked predictable questions, and I responded with cliched answers. Our obligations completed, I seized on the chance of making a routine day memorable, though I was probably twice her age. How about a drink somewhere? Otis made a sound. A snicker, I think. I expected a refusal, but she said,
"It's kinda early for that, but okay."
I half suspected her acceptance had been designed to counter Otis's derisive sneer. I cast a smug glance in his direction. "You fellows finish up here." He scowled and restarted the gravedigger. I turned to Jillian. "Your dragonfly or mine?"
"Mine, I guess. Devian's paying for it."
The bar at Dealey Tower offered an expansive view of the hard, gleaming city in the midday sun. Skyscrapers danced in a wavy mirage of heat. The serene, refrigerated air of the bar barely disturbed the paper lanterns hanging from the ceiling. So, Jill, how long have you been with DVN?
Don't you have a better line than that?
I reappraised her. She'd been around. How old are you anyway?
Well, at least that's direct. 23. You?
34, I lied.
So, is your work done? I mean, there are no more graves to,
exhume?
Right. Why can't I remember that word? What's next?
More of the same.
But there are no more...
We're compiling a database of Columbaria. Sooner rather than later, they'll be targeted and outlawed. Of course, some citizens keep ashes at home. Not many places left to scatter them. I'll bet you have some at your apartment.
Well, yes. I have about a half dozen ancestors in a closet.
What about your family 4 or 5 generations down the road? How will there be space to store everyone? What about your parents? Considering your age, I assume they're still living?
Yeah. They'll be around for a long time, I think.
By then, all the Columbaria may be gone.
There'll be protests.
Not so many as you think. Most people are less attached to ashes than they were to bodies. We'll roll out an ad campaign in advance to mold public opinion.
What will happen to all the ashes?
Still working on that. Dump somewhere. Oceans, most likely. Some suggested shooting them into space. It's a romantic notion. Maybe we'll present that to the public as the ultimate solution, but it's way too expensive. It'll never happen. All this is off the record, you know. Can't have this getting out before we're ready.
Yeah, okay.
Her eyes held mine for a moment.
I'm sad for you. It's a lousy job.
She touched my hand. There are so few jobs, I'm glad to have it. I let several seconds pass. Come home with me. She sighed and gazed out the window.
I don't think so.
She withdrew her hand.
I'd better get back to the office. Thanks for the drink.
Give me your number. I'll call you. She shook her head.
No, but it's okay to tell your gravedigger crew that you slept with me. I didn't like their snickering attitude.
That's not my style. I'd been a long time without a girlfriend, but didn't feel the need to impress Otis and his crew. She gave a tilt of her head.
Suit yourself.
I declined her offer of a lift back to the cemetery and watched her leave, wishing for a different ending. It had become so hard to connect with anybody. I signaled for another drink before returning to work.
This is Debbie Johnson reading The 1205 by G.O. Clark. Each night at 12:05 sharp, the train whistle repeatedly blows a kind of Morse code warning to anything on the tracks up ahead in the darkness. It's a well-known fact that evil things are attracted to the sound and wander down the tracks towards it, the engine's light pinning them like stage actors in the spotlight just before the final curtain. At daybreak, under the cloudless sky, the town folks start their day safe in the knowledge that the mess from the night before will have been cleared away. The zombie hordes shy a few more members. The morning train right on schedule.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading The 9,000,000,001 Names of God, written by Amy Ogden. Sure, I'll state my name for the record. It's Maggie Rogers with a D, like and Hammerstein, not like Mister. Where should I start? All the way at the beginning? So on paper, the project was called the Super Simulation, but privately we called it the 9,000,000,000 Names of God, Hard to get research funding under the auspices of an inside joke. But we did get funding from 27 countries and 4 independent research organizations and a couple dozen billionaires who thought this flavor of good PR was more interesting than, I don't know, ending world hunger or curing tuberculosis or something like that. No one's ever built a supercomputer this powerful. Maybe no one ever will again. I don't know. Takes a lot of money to keep it running, sure, but also a lot of cat herding to keep MIT, South Korea, the owner of the London Lions, all at the same table. No, I didn't have anything to do with it. You can thank our marketing folks for that one. The end result, of course, is the most detailed, most accurate simulation of the universe that's ever been devised. And yes, that one I will take some of the credit for. Not all, of course. That was a team effort. Feeding in the data, the fundamental laws of the universe, that's where the inside joke came in, see? Those were the names of God. You get it? E equals MC squared, there's one name. The ideal gas law, there's another, and so on. And then layers upon layers of refining the output, bending the world we'd made toward the world we lived in. Some of that was automated, sure, but you'd be surprised just how much hands-on time it takes to create the whole damn universe from scratch. And of course, that's what we were doing, even if we didn't realize it at first. That would have been a hell of a thing to write into a grant application, wouldn't it? Wasn't till about 2 years in that we started to notice that what was happening, what was really happening. If you make a simulation of the universe that's good enough, powerful enough, at some point it's not so much a simulation anymore. It's just plain old Universe Junior. All right, yes, the next part. That's the one I can't take full credit for so much as full blame. I took lead on input, after all. You can check the digital signatures. The credentials for those later entries are all mine. When did it start? I think it must have been just about after the third round of the water riots. When the South Side had no power, but up here in our nice cozy campus in the suburbs, we were running bright and warm. I thought I could make just some little edits, fine-tuning, right? Maybe no one would even notice, or that's what I convinced myself. A little bit of bias towards sentience, a tweak towards stability. From there, it wasn't a big jump to some of the really important stuff. Plugging kindness, fairness, diversity, and beauty in right alongside the laws of gravity. Be good to one another, damn it, baked right into the crust of the universe, so that mercy and grace are ever-increasing arrows right alongside entropy. Do you really mean to tell me, if you had the chance to take a chisel to the cold, stony face of the world as you know it, you'd just turn your back and walk away? I know that this isn't what this hearing is for, but we've all heard that the investors are talking about pulling the plug, that the money poured in isn't worth it now, and the data coming out isn't congruent to our universe anymore. The money! Jesus Christ, have you thought about what if we could ask, if we could talk to the beings in there? Have you thought about what they could tell us? I sure have. And as for why we're all really here today, well, if the board wants to fire me, sue for damages to the project, I'm sure you'll do what you think is right. That's what I did, after all. I can live with the rest because God has a bajillion and one names now, all right? And the last one is justice. And I'm proud to say I scribbled it in there myself.
This is Lynn Berla, and I'll be reading How Does She Do It? by Jane O'Reilly. Dr. Abrams steps away from the waist-high rectangular tank. He has checked the readings for the final time.
It's ready,
he says.
You can open it as soon as you want.
There are 20 identical tanks in the room, individually numbered, a screen on the side of each one showing the status of contents. I know what they are, although not who they are. That is kept strictly confidential. Nerves squeeze my belly. My palms are slick with sweat, though I try to hide it, fiddling with the strap of my crocodile skin bag, which I have positioned to hide the post-baby belly that I haven't yet been able to completely get rid of. It's been 2 weeks. I had hoped that I would be back in shape by now, but it always pays to have a backup plan. I can't afford to take too long off. The public has a short memory, and I am not going to risk being pushed aside for someone younger and firmer. Thankfully, Dr. Abram has the solution.
Would you prefer it if I waited outside?
He asks now.
It is just that some people prefer to do this privately. It can be quite strange. You might think you know how you are going to react, but it is not always that easy to predict.
I fix him with a smile that hides my nerves. It's an Oscar-winning smile, and I know exactly how it looks, with an added tilt of my head to emphasize my perfect cheekbones and full lips. Of course not. I press my index finger against the lock. There's a subtle flash and then a click. It's all very dramatic. There's a huff of smoke as the lid releases, a moment when I have to admit that I hold my breath, and then the lid swings open to reveal the contents within. These are not so glamorous. Thick yellow fluid fills it almost to the brim, obscuring the contents within. It begins to drain away. I lean closer, desperate to see, to inspect her, to make sure that she is worth the price I had paid. She is. Oh, she is. Thighs so slender that it seems impossible for them to support the rest of her body. Delicate hands, perfect skin, and the face. The face. Thank you, I say to Dr. Abram. She's perfect. You are truly a genius. She's exactly what I asked for. And so she should be, given what she cost. The services of this man do not come cheap. I had my DNA sample stored years ago in preparation for this. Everyone does, though none of us will admit to it. Dr. Abram doesn't advertise. Whispered conversations and corners of parties held in dramatic Beverly Hills mansions do that for him. I knew what sort of business I was getting myself into back when I first came here. A young, but neither naive nor innocent 19. I saw how ruthless it could be. Audiences demand perfection, but they want it to be natural. They scorn the aging actresses with their stretched faces, their rubbery lips, their lumpen implants. I was not going to let that happen to me. So I scraped together the money, a stolen watch or two, some unpaid rent, some films I have since made sure are buried. Who has time to recover from plastic surgery, from childbirth? Obviously, a surrogate can be used for that, but audiences don't like it. They want to know that we are as real as them. They also expect to see us sewn back into a size zero couture gown 3 weeks after the birth.
You're welcome,
he says. He too leans over the tank and checks his handiwork.
Yes, she's a good one.
Better than good. I am already imagining her walking the red carpet in 10 days' time. I'm due to start shooting my next film the week after that. Perhaps I will send her instead. I would much rather spend some more time lying at the side of my pool and drinking margaritas than sweating it out on location in Brazil. I'll get back to fighting weight soon, of course. But a few weeks of relaxation first can't hurt, can it? How soon will she be ready to work?
By the end of the day.
As quickly as that?
She needs to be cleaned and properly checked,
he says.
And then, of course, there's the memory programming, but that will only take a couple of hours.
When will that be done?
No time like the present.
I follow him out of the room, down the short corridor, and through into another room similar to the first, white and sterile, with a stainless steel table and chair to one side. I take the chair. We have already discussed what will happen. The procedure is fairly straightforward, for me anyway. A mapping of the cortical networks inside my brain, primarily the nerve pathways which hold my memories like the words in a book. Once that is done, the brain matter of my clone will be forced to grow those same pathways, a lifetime of experience crammed into a few short hours. You'll only give her the memories we discussed? I ask, as Dr. Abram brings over the scanner that will read and map my brain. I don't want her to know she's a clone. The last thing I want is for her to find out and make a mess of everything. Everyone has to believe she's really me. She has to believe it. That is the key to this whole thing. Once I've finished with her, she'll be brought back here and disposed of anyway. And you'll dispose of her properly once she's finished with?
Of course,
Dr. Abram says kindly as he adjusts the scanner and then clips it into position against my forehead. I feel something sharp press against the side of my neck. I don't remember agreeing to that. I try to slap it away, but it's too late.
I always do.
This is Dan Oliver reading Only G62 Kids Will Remember These Five Moments by Leonard Dalton Richardson. 1. The Course Correction. Astronomy geeks were excited about Ephraim when it was just a point on the map, but for the non-nerds among us, excitement grew slowly along with the star's disk. By the time we entered the star system, someone had learned how to activate the viewports. They'd been activated, and everyone with any free time was crowded around them looking out. Out! Could you imagine being so excited about the outside? G62 doesn't have to imagine. We remember. Most of all, we remember the correction itself. The centrifugal tug of gravity, the ship coming so close to Ephron, we saw the bulge of its engulfed first planet, a dead world plowing through the star's cold red atmosphere. It was the first course correction in 15 generations, and hopefully the closest we'll ever come to a star. G58 and G59 planned the maneuver, but we were the ones who got the full experience. We were young and curious, and we saw a close-up view of something big happening in this mostly empty universe. 2. Orange juice toxicity. We've all been there. You steal an orange from a greenhouse, rip off the peel, suck out the juice, and end up writhing on the dirt in untold agonies. Yes, oranges, the forbidden fruit. Their name is the same color as they are. So delicious, yet so heartless in their short-term effects on the central nervous system. What kept us coming back for more? The mystery was solved when we got older and learned that oranges aren't toxic at all. Those negative reactions were false memories implanted into the G62 to stop us from committing orange genocide. Kids have always stolen fruit from the greenhouses, but in G62, the normal background level of orange theft became an epidemic that threatened the genetic diversity of the species. Now that we're no longer kids, plus candy is better now. We don't need to steal oranges to get our sugar. But it's a safe bet that no one from G62 will ever eat one of those bastard fruits again. 3. Entitled G61ers. G61 was birthed in an emergency after most of G60 were wiped out by genetic defects, and they've never let us forget it. They're the emergency babies, and they've got to have everything their way. Mass media, packaged foods, concentration schools, market capitalism, all the old tricks were pulled out of storage, and every societal variable was rearranged to handle the largest generation in 200 years. Then G62 came through that distended pipeline, and it turned out those systems were kept in storage for a reason. They were terrible ideas that weren't suited to raising a normal-sized generation. But G61 refused to change a thing. After all, it was good enough for them. What a mess. If G62er sometimes seems bitter, it's because too often we're treated like the slow kids who were late to G61. 4. Mr. Kim. Of course, it wasn't all bad living in G61's hand-me-downs. We all remember Mr. Kim, the teleducator who did a better job teaching kids over video than any concentration school teacher could do in person. Mr. Kim was an okay teacher when he was working on G61, but he learned fast. And by the time G62 came along, he was the best. Everyone in G62 remembers Mr. Kim's patience. He never judged you for semantic mistakes. He'd just smile like he'd heard a joke and say, "Are you sure?" in a gentle tone that told you to revisit your priors. Always looking spiffy in his rumpled hair and his trademark corduroy sweater jacket, Mr. Kim was definitely the greatest innovation ever to come out of literacy training. I say innovation because after Mr. Kim's substrate was destroyed along with Arcology A, we learned that he wasn't even human. He was a computer simulation called artificial intelligence, another one of those ancient tools that G59 pulled out of humanity's toolkit to deal with the double-sized G61. It makes sense in retrospect. How else could Mr. Kim give individual instruction to thousands of students? But we're still heartbroken. Mr. Kim may be gone, but we'd be willing to go to those awful schools again just to bring him back. 5. The killer bunny craze. All kids love furry woodland creatures, but G59 was the first generation who had to fight them off in fear of their lives. When the bunnies started showing up outside the Arcologies, it was cute enough. But soon enough, the bunnies learned how good human beings tasted, and it went from adorable to infestation faster than you could scream, "No, don't rip my throat out!" Then, as suddenly as they'd appeared, the bunnies were gone, never to return. G59 and G61 isolated them in Arcology A and jettisoned the whole damn thing, tragically destroying the substrate used for Mr. Kim and the other artificial intelligences, plus a few species of grass. But it's tough to cry about grass as long as we've still got the basic green kind. It's unclear whether they were actually bunnies. I've heard that they were river otters or genetically modified freaks from the ship's store of dinosaur DNA. Conspiracy theorists say they were invading aliens who took the shape of bunnies. Now that I write this down, it sounds a little silly, like the orange juice thing. I'm starting to think there might not have been any killer bunnies at all. But really, does it matter? It was so long ago, and this is what we all remember.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.